slide. I really would like to continue with our programme, just as you have. So I'm delighted this morning to welcome Professor Roger Watson. I've known Roger for quite a few years, and he's probably well known to most of you. He is a graduate of the University of Edinburgh with a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Sheffield, and then he qualified in nursing at St George's Hospital in London. Working in the care of older people, he has a special interest in feeding and nutritional problems of older people with dementia. He's editor-in-chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing and editor of Nursing Open. He's a frequent visitor to the Far East, that's where we were together in Hong Kong in March, and I think since then he's been back a couple of times, backwards and forwards in China, Hong Kong, and Australia. He is a professor of nursing at the University of Hull in the United Kingdom, and was a member of the United Kingdom 2014 Research Excellence Framework subpanel for allied health professions, dentistry, nursing, and pharmacy. So without any further hesitation, I'll just offer the floor to Dr. Roger. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay? Oh, good. I can hear myself, so that's a good sign. I just plugged this in. Yes, I've been spending a lot of time in the Far East lately. You've got to find out what Hugh McKenna's up to somehow. He's just come in. He spends about as much time there as I do. It's really nice to be here. I lectured here once before a long time ago, and there were a row of nuns at the back in their habits, and I made a comment along the lines of writing's a matter of what's in your head, not inspiration from God or anyone like that. It caused a little bit of shuffling in the back row, I can tell you. And it's really nice to see two friends from Guangzhou, where I was 2 weeks ago, here all the way to Dublin. You must be feeling very cold. It's a bit different here from the weather in Guangzhou a couple of weeks ago, which was in the 40s or something like that, and 85% humidity. Okay, I've only got 45 minutes. Originally I was given an hour yesterday, but with a mix-up over flights and times, I'm really glad, really pleased to be fitted in this morning. So I want to talk about covering tips for getting published and some future directions in publishing. And this is really a kaleidoscope rather than a coherent talk, picking on different bits and pieces from various sessions that I do. And as Sonia said, I'm editor of Journal of Advanced Nursing, which is a traditional pay-to-view journal. I mean, your libraries or your hospitals pay to put this into their libraries. So you can look at it normally for free. Nursing Open, which is the other journal I've edited. So by the way, Jan is 41 years old. Nursing Open's 4 years old. Very different kind of journal. It's a pay-to-publish and open access online-only journal. Very different model. Both offer open access facilities, but the one on the bottom right is purely open access. And I'm going to come back to open access at the end, because it's a huge, that is one of the future directions, something we've got to look out for, because it's good and there are some bad aspects to it as well, as I'm sure you know. Anyone who's published will be inundated with emails on a daily basis, often up to 20 or 30, inviting you, greeting you, inquiring about your health, usually with some bad spelling, and asking you to contribute to their esteemed journal. So that's how most people see the publishing process. It's different parts of the world. This slide gets different reactions. It usually gets a laugh in the West, and I'm not so sure when I was over in Guangzhou if people thought it was meant to be serious or not. But so this is you or me. I'm an author as well, with your manuscript virtually in your hot little hand, trying to get it up there to where it's going to be accepted. And all it seems like when you're trying to get published is there are all these blighters along the way trying to stop you, you know. That's me, that's the editor-in-chief, the first line of defence. And the rest of these people are I've got five editors, as it happens, so we could stick names on all of these people. But it does seem like that. And you don't always get published. You sometimes get rejected, as I'm sure you know. You have got to be aware of that. I can't give you a guaranteed way of getting from the left hand to the top right of that diagram. What I can do is give you one or two things that might increase your chances. I can certainly tell you how not to get to the end of that. That's easy. Basically, you don't do some of the things that I'm going to talk about. But you know, I can't guarantee any route to the top. But there are certainly things you can do to maximise your chances. And I'm going to talk about some of these over the next few minutes. I'm going to talk about, you know, publishing standards and also one or two things about actually writing papers. Now, this is how not to write a paper. I think that this is a real picture, obviously, but it's actually from a colleague of mine with whom I was writing a paper. And I asked her, how's it going? And she said, took a photograph and said, how do you think it's going? And this was, she's from Thailand, long dark hair, you know, she's got a hair band, clip her hair back. She's got a packet of biscuits, hand cream, mobile phone, blank screen, surrounded by every paper that she's ever read, all marked up and ready to be chiseled into or hammered into this article. And I think in terms of actually writing papers, this is not the way to do it. One of the, you know, you won't get published unless you write a paper, that's for sure, unless you write a manuscript. And I think sitting surrounded by everything is a really bad way to do it. By all means, read all this stuff, but I learned a long time ago, shove it away, put it in the next room, leave it in your office or leave it at home, and sit and write what you want to write. Otherwise, you just won't, it's very difficult to get to the end of it. So try and get out of the habit of sitting surrounded by all the things that you've read relevant to your paper, because it can lead, of course, to plagiarism. That's one thing it can lead to. You don't necessarily say things in your own words, but it also leads to that desire to get absolutely everything in, whether it's relevant or not, simply because you've read it. The best way to write is to write what you want to write and then find what you've got that might support it. If you can't support it, you've either got to take it out or claim it as your own idea. So that's the part of the process of writing, and as I say, I learned that a long time ago. In fact, I learned it on a train from Dublin to Belfast once when I was living in Dublin. I was writing a paper, and I usually had a rucksack full of these manuscripts with me to check when I was writing a paper, and I left it because I left in a hurry, and oh gosh, I'll never manage to write this paper now. And in fact, I finished it on the train, you know, so I wasn't sitting looking at all these manuscripts. Now, this is not an advert for the Journal of Advanced Nursing, but just to show you, using Journal of Advanced Nursing as an example, last year, for the year for which we've got full statistics, we had over 1,000 submissions. That's actually down slightly on previous years, but I reckon with the forthcoming research excellence framework exercise in the UK, it'll go up again because the UK is the top submitters to the journal. 56 countries. Just the point I'm trying to make here is really you're up against a lot of competition. And we only publish roughly 300 papers a year, so you've got a 1 in 4, 1 in 5, all things being equal, a 1 in 5 chance of being published in the journal. But all things are not equal, because my job, and I did it this morning in the hotel, my job as editor-in-chief is to look at the papers when they come in, and I'm the first person to see them. They come directly to my inbox on the Journal of Advanced Nursing System, and I've got to make a quick decision. I mean, a few minutes per paper. I don't read the manuscripts from beginning to end. I look at the title, I look at the abstract, I sometimes have a look at the paper to just look for certain features, but it's really got to make an impression very quickly, and you really, as the saying goes, you've only got one chance to make that first impression. So to get into the, at least to get into the review system, you've got to get certain things right, and again, I'll mention that in just a minute. And just as a brief, not to do with the Journal of Advanced Nursing, but just to show you, the publishing world is changing. I mean, the United States has always been the biggest area of publishing and is likely to remain so. UK is sort of used to be second behind that, but look at mainland China catching up and taking over. And the green areas, which is the Middle East, which is where I've been spending some time this year as well, are the fastest growing areas. So the competition is just going up. I can never remember how many papers are published every second, how many academic papers, but it can be counted in seconds. But there are millions of papers published every year. So the competition is just growing and growing. And to accommodate that, open access journals have come on the scene to some extent, some of them good and some of them just quite frankly bad. Okay, so if you want to get published, you've got to understand the publishing process, and the process is quite simple. What you've got to do is write first for editors. Think of what the editors want. And the editors, we're quite simple people. What we want to see is a paper that fits the scope of the journal, the aims and scope of the journal, which you can read in the aims of the journal, under the guidance for authors. You know, an extreme example would be we don't want to see papers on nuclear physics in the Journal of Advanced Nursing, but neither do we want to see purely medical papers. We want things that are relevant to nursing. We're pretty broad. But for any journal, think of the editors first. They want to see papers that fit the journal. They want to see papers that follow the guidance for the journal. That's absolutely crucial. There's nothing sort of insults an editor more if the guidance isn't followed. And I would say that at least 50% of the papers that I ditch every morning are not following the guidance. Simple as that. Some journals may have time to say, could you attend to this? We don't. So if you're trying to hit a journal that's got a big turnover and lots of submissions, you won't get a second chance if you don't follow the guidance. And it's actually quite simple to do that. Then think of your reviewers. So your reviewers, we hope, are experts in the field. In nursing, we hope to get clinical experts and methodological experts. And you've got to treat your reviewers as such. And the editors are experts to some extent, but we can't be expert in everything. So, you know, try not to take shortcuts in explaining what you're doing. If it's a clinical article, make sure that you're up to date on what the clinical developments are in that field. If you're if you're talking about methodologies, particularly more exotic or complex methodologies, you've really got to explain to the reviewers or show the reviewers that you know what you're doing. I don't actually deal with reviewers now as an editor-in-chief, thank goodness, because that's the hardest job in editing. But when I did, one of the most common comments from editors, from reviewers, who were either rejecting a paper or questioning it for major revisions was, I don't understand what the author has done. They haven't explained themselves clearly. So you've got to write your paper as if you're writing it for somebody who doesn't really know what you're doing. And one of the best ways to do that is to get someone else to have a look at it. And finally, you've got to think of your audience, but you won't reach your audience if you don't satisfy the editors and get past the reviewers. So don't worry when you set out to write a paper like I used to do, you know, how exciting will it be if my mother sees this or my colleagues see this and all that. You know, your mother, your colleagues, your wife, husband or whatever, partner, they won't see it if you don't go through the process. And it is a process. You've just got to tick boxes for editors and tick boxes for reviewers. And honestly, if you do, you could be, in my journal, for example, one of the 20% of people who do get published. It's not impossible. So I've got what I've boiled down to four rules of writing. Before I get on to the sort of publishing process, this is about how to actually produce a paper, and I'm not going to go into these in detail. I've got a whole session on this. It's on YouTube if you want to watch it. But my first rule of writing is to read the guidelines for whatever you're doing, particularly for refereed international journals. And the guidelines are easily available. As I say, the most common reason for me rejecting a paper at the first line, or the first pass, as it were, is that they haven't followed the guidelines, which suggests to me that they haven't actually looked at papers in the journal. That's another way to find out how to lay them out and what the standards are. Simple things like getting the referencing right. If I see a paper with Vancouver referencing when we use Harvard, and I know it's easy to press a button on RefMan to change it, I don't care. It should have been done before it got to the journal. So we're quite hard on this, and I think any other editors like Ian Norman from the International Journal of Nursing Studies and colleagues from Nurse Education Today would say exactly the same thing. If you're going to write, this is getting back to my slide with my friend with all her papers set around her. To write a paper, you need to set yourself targets and count words. So try and set yourself realistic targets. Don't try and think of a paper, or a manuscript at least, in terms of the 5,000 words that you've got to write. Because if you do, you'll then think, well, I may have to revise this 5 or 6 times or even more, and you're thinking about 20,000 words or whatever, and it becomes very daunting. Now, try and write 500 words a day, or if 500 words every time you sit down to write. Don't try and write the whole thing. Try and break it down into small tasks and build it up that way. I find that very effective, and I know that my PhD students, when they get into problems with writing, find it effective too. Problem with PhD students is they leave it all to the last minute. They've got a month to go and they've got 100,000 words to write. But when you're an academic writing papers, or as a PhD student producing papers, you probably don't have that kind of pressure, and you can break it down. But you do have to keep going over that time. Write, don't edit, just get it down, sort the mess out after you've done it. Now, a thing that people often forget, especially those who are not writing in teams, and of course if you're a PhD student, you'll have a supervisor built into the equation, you should always let them see what you're writing. You should never send a paper off for publication if other people haven't had a look at it. And the best people to look at it are not necessarily experts. The best people to look at it sometimes, in my case, are often my PhD students on my papers or my research assistants, and they often wonder, why would I show it to them? I said, well, could you show me anything that's not clear? And, you know, once you give them license to do that, you find out that's not clear, that's not clear, that's not clear, and you've got to make it clear. And that's often what reviewers are actually asking you to do, clarify, clarify, clarify. So try and preempt that aspect of the review by giving it to someone else to look at beforehand. So seek some criticism, positive and negative criticism. It's no use getting the departmental maniac who always says everything's bad, or the huggy bear who says everything's good. Get people who will give you realistic feedback. And the fourth rule is, every time you get a rejection, make that the start of the next submission. Never give up, okay? There's too many colleagues and certainly students give up when they get even revisions to do. Well, that's it. You know, can't do any more after that. They don't like it. Well, sit down, read it again. The door's open, you know. But if it's rejected, then that's your signal just to start again. Where's it going to go to next? And all my best colleagues, and one of them sitting over there, and Ian Deary, with whom I've worked a lot in the UK, every time a paper's rejected, first thing is, where's it going next? That's just the word on their lips. I learned that a long time ago, and that's the way to think. So make a start, and don't—I don't like cliches—but don't put all your metaphorical eggs in one cliched basket. You know, try and have a range of journals that you're aiming at. Don't think it's the Lancet or bust, you know, or BMJ or bust, or even Journal of Advanced Nursing or bust. Think, if it's Journal of Advanced Nursing you're aiming for, that's fine. Then you might not get in there. What's a similar journal? Well, there's Journal of Clinical Nursing, International Journal of Nursing Studies, although that's nearly impossible to get into. Or you can, Nurse Education Today, which is now above us, you know. But have a sort of target that you're aiming for. You know, different journals will move into the middle of that. If you get rejected, just move out to the periphery, bring another one in, keep going. You will get published eventually. And there's a list of 114 nursing journals on the Thomson Reuters Impact Factor list, if that's where you're aiming. And now there's a whole lot more on the emerging journals list that you can be looking at to think where you might want to put your paper. So always think about that in advance. And always, and I absolutely always, have a journal in mind when you're writing the first manuscript. Because you'll have to have one in mind when you're writing the second one, because if you're revising it, you may have to change it. But never, ever write a manuscript and then think, now, where could this go? Get the guidance, get a journal, write it to those standards, and then you won't have to mess about with it too much afterwards. I've been saying that in China repeatedly over the last couple of weeks, as my colleagues will know, and I'm still getting manuscripts from some other colleagues that haven't been written for a journal. So it's a good start to be clear where it's going to go. So that's not an advert for the Journal of Advanced Nursing, but I'm using the Journal of Advanced Nursing as the obvious example. Our impact factor's just gone up, nearly two, not as good as it could be. But the most important thing here is the author guidelines. You know, they're on the front page of the journal. Every journal will have guidance on the front page. Click on it, read it. Don't read at all. There's hundreds of pages of guidance on our journal, but read what's specific to your journal, to your paper. Sorry, if you want to do a systematic review or an RCT, read that specific guidance. It's there for you, and it's there to help you, and it will tell you everything that you need to know, and it's constantly updated. Just for your interest, we now publish accepted manuscripts. As soon as one of my editors has sent it to me to be recommending an acceptance, and once I've done the final sort of, my little edit of it and said, right, that's accepted, within a day it goes online as a manuscript. It's not corrected. You know, there's a health warning there. It's just the Word document created into a PDF. It just looks like your manuscript. Not corrected. You know, health warning's there, but it's got a DOI, so it can be cited right from that point. Then, once it's gone through that process and been corrected by you and by me, it goes on early view, and it normally goes on early view as a PDF, fully published, within about 6 weeks of acceptance. So we try and do this very quickly so that you get as many reads and citations as possible, and so do we. And then some way down the line it goes into a volume of the journal, but that step is almost irrelevant these days. Okay, so seeking criticism, you know, get a great critic. Get people who are willing to engage with your writing and actually show you this is wrong, that's wrong. Nothing's too small for them to actually help you to sort out. So find a critical friend, you know. So don't get that sort of person. That's no good. Or that's no good. You need, sorry ladies, a sexist picture of a man helping a woman up a mountain. I get slaughtered for this very often, but say, you know what I mean. Somebody's, you know, hopefully somebody who's been there before, but somebody who's willing to extend the hand and help you. And learn in your own careers as well, because it helps your writing if you're willing to read other people's work and to help them. Right, so moving on to publishing. I mean, I'm hoping to leave a few minutes at the end for questions if you want that. And also, I'm around at the STTI conference until Saturday. People can grab me or whatever if they want to ask me questions. I meant to say that at the beginning. But these days, to get published, there's a whole network of publishing standards. When I started out in the industry, the guidance for submitting a paper was on the back of the journal. It was, but you know, in large letters, you know, put 3 copies of the manuscript in an envelope, send them to the journal and wait. You know, that was the instructions. And these days there are copious instructions. And alongside that, links to all sorts of standards for different kinds of papers. I'm sure you're aware of these. The place to find these standards is the Equator Network webpage. And it's well worth having a look at that. That could be your homework tonight. And the Equator Network webpage has a growing list of standards for RCTs, systematic reviews, cohort studies, qualitative studies, protocols and all sorts of things. But the main ones that I want to look at are the consort guidance for randomised controlled trials, and there's also the PRISMA guidance. Those are the ones that are most commonly used. And we expect to see these used if you're submitting these kinds of papers. So the Consort has a web page. You can go to it directly through Google. And on the web page, the most important things to look out for are the checklist and the flow diagram. And the checklist, it's not how to do an RCT, although it's quite helpful to look at it before you do one, but it's how to present it and the sort of things that you need to have done in the paper. And it actually tells you how to write the paper. We accept manuscripts in the format of the Consort checklist. So we're expecting to see that checked off. You don't have to have achieved everything, because every trial doesn't achieve all of that, but you've got to give an explanation of why you might not have done that. So we expect to see that submitted along with the paper, and we also expect to see the flow diagram. And sorry, it's not a very good slide, but the flow diagram looks like this. I'm sure you've seen them these days if you're looking at trials. It takes account of everybody who could have been in your trial, in other words, the population that you were drawing it from, the sample you took from the population, your sampling frame, the people who met or didn't meet the criteria, those who went into the randomisation arms, and then everybody who dropped out after that. So that everybody who's in the trial at the beginning and everybody who's in it at the end is accounted for, and you can do your intention to treat analysis at the various levels. So that's expected. One of the common problems I know with this and with the PRISMA flow diagram is you start at the bottom and add up as a reviewer, and it doesn't add up to N at the top. It's got to add up. Everybody's got to be accounted for. So, simple thing, if you're doing an RCT, you've got to present the consort flow diagram. Also, please note, those of you who are trialists of any kind, in actual fact, I would say for any study involving patients these days, even if it's cohort or quasi-experimental, but for trials, for clinical trials, it's absolutely compulsory that they're registered in advance. My publishers, Elsevier, Sage, all the big publishers, all adhere to the All Trials campaign, the work of Ben Goldacre there in the middle. The All Trials campaign says that trials have to be registered in advance, the protocol has to be registered in advance, and that all trials have to be published, whether the results are negative or positive or neutral, and we're all committed to that. So it doesn't make any difference if your trial hasn't worked, as it might say. We are committed to we can't reject it on that basis. There may be other reasons for rejecting it. So the All Trials campaign, worth having a look at that. And it's easy to register trials, so relatively easy. One of the most common places to do it is in the States at clinicaltrials.gov, but your university or your hospital has to be linked up to this. I know there's a Chinese clinical trials registry site, which we accept, and there's also a European one, which people in this country might be able to use for a while. We won't be able to use it after a couple of years because we're no longer going to be in Europe, because I come from the UK. But there is a European trial site as well. Ironically, there's not one in the UK that I know of, unless somebody can tell me. But most people use clinicaltrials.gov. Okay, the next piece of guidance, again, I'm absolutely sure you've seen this, but I just want to make sure that you've seen it, is the PRISMA guidance for systematic reviews. And again, it's got a web page which is very similar to the other web page, because it's Moher in Canada who produces all these guidance. Again, a checklist of the flow diagram. Checklist does exactly the same thing. We expect to see the checklist completed or explained. And there's a flow diagram which does exactly the same job as the one for the systematic, for the randomized controlled trials. It accounts for everything that you found and everything that you finally reviewed. And you don't have to go down to the last level of meta-analysis, by the way. You can have a zero in there, because don't confuse meta-analysis. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that all systematic reviews have to be meta-analysis. That isn't true. So simple things that you can do if you're publishing these kind of papers is to make sure that you follow that guidance. Again, there's guidance for diagnostic trials, there's cohort guidance, and we like you to use this guidance if at all possible. Now, again, first part of your homework was to have a look at the Equator webpage. Second part of your homework, if you've never looked at the Committee on Publication Ethics webpage, the COPE webpage, again, very easy to Google it. I'd strongly advise it. This is an excellent resource for editors, authors, and for reviewers. And they've got a webpage. That's a reasonably recent version of the webpage. And on the webpage, there's resources available in different languages, including Chinese. There are flow charts which tell me what to do if I think you've done something wrong. And believe me, we hunt you to the ground. We hunt you to extinction if you don't own up. And and don't think this is uncommon. There's never a time as an editor-in-chief when I'm not dealing with something using the COPE flow charts. Ethical misdemeanors are really quite common. But very useful for you, it doesn't show the link there, I can't see it, but there is a link to codes of practice for authors, editors and reviewers. They're very handy, especially if you're beginning to become a reviewer. And they're not long, one of them's only one page of A4. Totally common sense, things that you probably knew, but but it's well worth having a look at these things. And, most journals, most good journals are signed up to COPE. Jan's been a member for quite a few years. So have a look at the COPE webpage, well worth having a look at. Another thing to have well worth having a look at is the ICMJE Medical Journal Editors page. Two things of interest here. One is they're very hot on conflicts of interest, which is something that we expect you to declare. Don't worry, I mean, a conflict of interest doesn't mean to say a paper shouldn't be published. A conflict of interest should be declared so that somebody can read it and interpret it correctly. So don't ever be afraid of stating conflicts of interest. And if you look on the webpage for the ICMJE, you'll see that there's an awful lot of potential conflicts of interest, things you may not have considered. But the other important piece that's kind of buried away here is who is an author. And the ICMJE are, again, very hot on authorship. And most journals in the medical and nursing and health fields subscribe to this particular set of guidance. Mostly they attenuate it slightly. They don't take such a hard line as the ICMJE. However, I should have shown you that there. I'll go back again. Basically what it says is anybody who's an author should have conceived the paper, had something to do with the data analysis and had something to do with writing the paper. But all authors have to agree to the final content. If you've done that, you should be an author. If you haven't, you shouldn't. And it's trying to get away from gift authorship on the one hand and missing people off on the other hand, you know. I'm a strong believer that research assistants should be authors on papers. You know, that wasn't the case at one time. They certainly fulfil that criteria, and they can easily fulfil it by reading the paper. I'm also a strong believer at the other end that PhD supervisors should be co-authors on PhD students' papers, because they've had a part in conceiving the project. Anyway, that's the two ends, but there should not be cases where people who've had nothing to do with the paper are on because they're nice or asking to be or are powerful. Usually it's men. And there's never a case for missing somebody off, because if you miss someone off a paper, their name can never be added to it once the DOI is ascribed to it. Their name can be put on Medline, but that when they print the paper off, their name is never on it. So it's a really serious thing. Right. Okay, and just to be clear, most good publishers these days use Authenticate or similar software to look for similarity. I mean, it's preventing plagiarism and duplication, but it's really looking at similarity. So just be aware. I mean, you must know this already, but don't duplicate or plagiarise. Don't be tempted. And I would say, if you've any doubts about your fellow authors, your supervisors, or your PhD students when you're grown up and past the stage, or when you're working with other colleagues, if you've any suspicions about them, run the paper through a similarity checker. I've caught a couple of people out this way, and my name would have been mud had it gone forward, and with my name on the paper. So if you've any doubts, you know, make sure that your colleagues are working to the highest standards as well. Because it can be serious. Papers can be retracted, and it can be very serious. There's a case of one paper from the Journal of Advanced Nursing before I joined it, where the person was accused of duplication, and it was upheld with the International Journal of Nursing Studies. They lost their job, so the consequences can be very, very serious. Now, one of one of the things that is important in papers is to make them internationally relevant, especially for international journals. And this is not as difficult as it seems. One of the main ways to do this is to make sure that you review the international literature and place your study within it. It doesn't matter if a study's from Dublin or from Guangzhou or wherever. It matters that you make sure that you're relating your work to the wider body of knowledge. International doesn't necessarily mean geographical. It means, you know, global in the sense of covering the whole discipline or covering that whole field of research. However, you know, making things international in the geographical sense is quite important too. We really firmly believe at the Journal of Advanced Nursing that you shouldn't mention countries in the titles of papers. We've noticed one of my editors, Mark Cater, did a bit of work on our citations and discovered that papers with countries in the article title just weren't being cited for some reason. It's a put-off for some people. Now, some journals insist you put them in, you've just got to do what they say, but we would tend not to. You've got to declare it in the paper, of course, where it's been done, but for some reason it seems to block people from looking at it. Well, it's just Dublin, I'm not interested in that, or it's just London or whatever. So don't shoot yourself in the foot with the title, but always keep asking yourself whether somebody in any region of the world will be able to understand what you're saying in your paper. For example, in the UK we have trusts, health trusts. They've no relevance anywhere else, but that's the organisational unit of our National Health Service, in England anyway. So, you've got to say, well, you've got to describe things in terms that other people will understand. In the abstract, try and make sure that you refer to the global relevance. Do include the names of the countries where the work was taken. That sort of situates it, and try and emphasise the international global relevance in the conclusion. Keep coming back to it. Somebody I know called Hugh McKenna once said, just get the word international in there and you should be okay. But it's quite true, actually. But don't overstate your findings, but take every chance you can to point out what is at least global and international about your work. Never make it local or small or anything like that. Try and make it big and relevant. Otherwise, it probably won't get published. Now, you've got to expect of several revisions. James Michener was asked if he's one of the world's greatest writers, and he said, no, I'm one of the world's greatest rewriters. You know, he kept at it. So you've got to expect to have revisions. Don't expect to get things done the first time, or even, through the first time. You will have to revise. But you do have to learn when to let go, and I find this as a problem with a lot of colleagues, especially PhD students, really finding it difficult to let go. And it's not easy to let go, because you might get rejected, of course, so you might get to do revisions you don't want to do. I'm afraid that there's no other way than just getting used to that. That's academic life. So you do have to have a point when, if you've written it and you're happy with it, you've given it to somebody to read and you've revised it, and then you're happy with it, you've let it sit for a few days, you've had another read of it and you're still happy with it, it's time to let it go. It won't be perfect. Nothing's perfect. So when you get reviewers' comments back, which you will do, apply the golden rules from Williams' golden rules. I can give people the reference to this if they want. Answer completely, answer politely, and answer with evidence. So answering completely means dealing with every point. Even if you don't agree with a point, you can't ignore it. You've got to say why, politely, of course. Make a list of the points, even if there's not a list of points given to you, and just put your response next to them, as well as doing it in the paper. Another hint is to do the changes in the paper in red font, if the journal allows you to do that. That does two things. It makes an impression on the editors and the reviewers. Oh, they've done them, that's good. It also stops them from reading the rest of the paper again to find the points and coming up with some other stupid review point that you don't want to do. Answer politely. Don't start with "we completely disagree with the comments of the reviewer" or "who on earth are your reviewers?" We've seen it all, and we try to get our reviewers to be polite, and we drop them if they're not. There's no need to be impolite, so we expect you to be as well. It won't help. And answer with evidence. You know, if you disagree, don't just say so. Provide facts and references. And I had a big disagreement over Cronbach's alpha with somebody in a paper once. My view is Cronbach's alpha is a fairly not the best measure of internal consistency, and there's a lot of evidence for that. I don't want to get into research methods here. And somebody, nonsense, Cronbach's alpha is perfectly robust. So I just gave a list of websites and references. The paper got accepted. So don't be afraid to tackle these things head on. Usually, people are quite happy. And it won't just be, the reviewers don't make the decision. The reviewers advise the editors, and the editors make the decision. And if they're happy with what you've done and how you've responded, they may not even send it out for a review again. So just have a go. Don't try and hide things up. Now, again, jumping on, these days you absolutely have to be into social media. We're big on it in the Journal of Advanced Nursing. I think we've got the biggest nursing Twitter following for any sort of academic nursing journal. And I say these days you've got to be into social media. We use it to promote your papers. I think you should be helping us by putting out the links on Twitter and Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever you happen to use. We provide facilities on our journal for Twitter, we've got a blog, we've got a YouTube, and we've got a, I think that's it actually, but we cover those aspects of social media, and we've got a LinkedIn site as well. You know, so we invite you to use these. Not many people do, but it's great when they do. Anything you can do to get your paper out there and noticed, because it's not just straightforward citations these days. There's some other measurement of it called altmetrics, which I'll come to. But you know, if you look at this paper here, within three levels of tweet, which can take a matter of seconds, one tweet gets out to nearly 20,000 people. Now, 10% of those people may read it, but that's a lot more than would have read it otherwise. So it's always worth getting stuff out on social media. And these days, there's evidence that twitations and twimpact are quite powerful. The more papers, there's a correlation between social media and citations as well. So it's quite useful. This paper here, the odds of an article being highly cited were significantly increased by mentions in social media, with a massive odds ratio. So there is some evidence, and it's growing. See, people take it. You can take pictures if you want, but you can email me at the end. I'll send you the slides. There's no problem at all. My email's on the end. And then, because these days we're also measuring altmetrics, and I think altmetrics and the impact factor system, at some point they're going to merge. So just pay attention. I'm coming to the end of my career. Altmetrics won't matter much to me, but the average age in this room is a lot younger, and in 5-10 years' time, I think this is going to be where it's at. And there are some countries in Europe which are already publishing people's altmetrics as part of their promotion system. Okay, Nursing Open. I'm not leaving a huge amount of time, but I'm not going to speak about Nursing Open, but just, this is the number of predatory publishers from Beale's site, which is now gone, unfortunately. A number of publishers from 2011 to 2016. a huge an order of magnitude increase in 5 years, and the number of journals likewise. So we're surrounded by these predatory journals. We're also surrounded by hijacked websites. Be careful. The bottom line here is don't respond to anybody asking you to publish in their journal. Just don't do it. Even if it seems to come from me, don't do it, because we never do it. Okay? So don't respond. If you're in any doubt about a paper, about a journal, check the Directory of Open Access Journals. It's not an absolute measure, but if it's in there, it means it's good. So, for example, Nursing Open has a green tick, which means it meets certain criteria. I won't go into the criteria just now. But if they're on the DOAJ, they should be okay. So that's one thing you can do to check if you're being bombarded by open access journals. But really, just ignore them. Just swipe left on your iPhone when you get these messages from them. Okay, I want to leave a couple of minutes for questions. There is a fantastic book that you can read. It's a little bit, looking at the date, it needs a little bit of updating, but there you go. Published by Wiley, but written by Karen Holland from Nurse Education Today and myself. If you want to send me any kind of abuse, that's my email. If you want to see what I've done over the last 25 years, you can check my ORCID site. And also, if you've really got absolutely nothing to do, you can follow me on Twitter. I'd be really happy to take a few questions if that's okay. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Roger. Well, I'm sure there's probably quite a few questions.